Money FM 89.3, the best of Saturday mornings. International News Review.
Welcome back to the show. Steve Okun joining us for our International News Review. Good morning, Steve.
Great to be back on this well-oiled machine of Saturday mornings.
Thank you, Steve.
We've been accused of a lot of things, but that's okay. Anyway.
Well, hey. We've certainly been well-oiled. See, my mic fell. As I said that, my mic fell. I got droopy mic.
All right, everybody. Steve, we got a few interesting topics to cover today. And let's revisit a little bit earlier in the week. The Vice President Harris goes to the DMZ and hails the strong and strategic U.S. alliance with North Korea. Oops.
Well, like, oops, but this is so overblown. It's crazy.
Okay.
She misspoke, right? You have the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the Republic of Korea. You know, DPRK, ROK. You don't say North Korea, South Korea. She slipped up. Big deal, right? The New York Post called this an unforced error of global proportions. Another headline was this was a diplomatic blunder. It was none of those things. She just misspoke. And it's too bad, right, because she delivered an extremely strong message. Mm-hmm. I mean, she called out North Korea as a brutal dictatorship, which, of course, it is. She said they have an illegal arms program. There's rampant human rights violations. They shot missiles towards her plane when she was coming into South Korea. So we have huge problems there, and people are harping on this. It's ridiculous that this is the focus. And I understand why it happens, but it's wrong.
Hang on a second. just play devil's advocate. When Kamala Harris, and the reason I did that is because I was pulled up on this show and told by the gentleman opposite me that pronunciations are important, particularly when it comes to President Harris and what her name represents.
Vice President Harris.
Yes. What did I say?
President.
I've just promoted her. Now, bearing all that in mind, had this been Donald Trump, would the left-leaning media of the U.S. not have had a field day?
A part of it, maybe not as much of a field day. And I'll tell you why. It's because the vice president has gotten this reputation of not being a player when it comes to international affairs, of not being a serious diplomatic
person. Not being up to the challenge.
And so this plays into that narrative, which is why you're getting so much of it. She misspoke, and it I think underscores a couple of issues we have. And I'll tell you, Neil, no, I think that some of this is misogyny and sexism when you attack a woman for doing this. So I think a little bit of it is that. I think a little bit of it is that she has made other little misstatements before. And when you put it into a narrative for somebody who is potentially going to be the Democratic nominee for president, it's not unexpected that this happens, but it is not what they say it is. This is not going to do anything with regards to the U.S. relationship with South Korea or the Republic of Korea, and it's not going to embolden the leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea or North Korea. So it's meaningless from an international diplomatic perspective, but it is meaningful if you think about how this is going to play out politically in the U.S., especially as we start to go into the presidential election cycle next year.
That is, I think, my perspective on it. I don't think that it's going to change relationships with Seoul and Washington and whatever. Everybody gets that she just made a mistake. I just don't understand how you can make that mistake when you are in the DMZ and when it is such a relationship that's fraught with danger and peril. I mean, any diplomat that's up there standing on that line. I've been up to the DMZ twice, and you just can't make that mistake. You just can't. And I get it. She misspoke, but wow.
Hey, that was a statement.
That wasn't a question.
As the vice president of the United States, you just can't make that mistake. It just can't be done.
It can be done. It was done. It has been done. Again, and it's not meaningful in any way to anyone who's following foreign policy. It's political fodder.
It's a political thing.
I get that. And that's all of it is.
Yeah.
Well, I think President Harris is doing a great job.
Well, and one of the things I you know, was hearing when I was back in the U.S. last week is, you know, the Biden administration is under fire for the border, what's happening at the southern border in Texas and immigrants and all that. And she is the immigration or the border czar or whatever. So it's just one more thing that she's going to be attacked upon for this upcoming election cycle. So. It is what it is, and that's what politics, you know, politicians do. They would have said the same thing about Trump. In fact, they did say the same thing about Trump when he met Kim Jong-un and went to the DMZ, and, you know, so let's call that what it is. But okay.
Yeah, I know it is. And what Donald Trump did significantly changed U.S. foreign policy, had significant impacts on what North Korea did when they felt that they have this, you know, wonderful relationship and there's love letters, as Donald Trump described them, between him and Kim Jong-un. That was meaningful and significant. This misstatement is not. It's a political issue, but it is not. You can't compare it to what Donald Trump did because he truly changed the playing field from foreign policy perspectives with Japan, with South Korea, with China, with the United States. This is just a misstatement. And she shouldn't have made it. And it's a mistake. People make mistakes. Let's move on. Of course, nobody will.
Well, let's move on indeed and bring in our regular viewer and listener, Ian Chan, and talk about the hurricane that Ian believes is named after him. Let's talk about Hurricane Ian. Now, I was saying to Glenn off air, I'm a bit of a shameless storm chaser. I'm glued to CNN during these things. It could have been me. Maybe I was distracted with Ukraine and other things happening. But this one seemed to sneak up, literally and metaphorically, on the news cycle and on the American government. How do you see Joe Biden's response and America's response generally to the latest hurricane?
Well, the issue here is when there are storms of this magnitude, like there's not Democratic hurricanes, there's not Republican tornadoes, it is a disaster. And when the parties, both parties, have to come together, they are going to get judged on whether they do a good job. And here you have the partnership between the federal government, led by Joe Biden, a Democrat, of course, and the Republican governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. And DeSantis is notorious for calling, you know, playing politics, referring to President Biden as Brandon, which is a derogatory term that the right uses against him. You know, DeSantis flew people legally in the United States from Texas, which isn't even his jurisdiction, to Martha's Vineyard to score political points. So he's very combative when it comes to politics. But they are working together very closely, President Biden and Governor DeSantis, because one, it is the right thing to do. When there is a disaster, the government has to come together. And it's the feds and the state that work together. The second, it's in both of their interests politically to work together. When the two sides work together, it benefits both of them. And when the two sides don't work together, it is bad politics, in addition to being bad governance.
The states like New York and New Jersey, Democratic states, sent assistance or are sending assistance to Florida. DeSantis thanked them, Democrats. He thanked President Biden and the national response. How long will the love fest last?
Like you hope this is going to be months.
The bipartisanship.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is the recovery. There's going to be months. I mean, the numbers they're putting on this. The last number says $120 billion in damage to the state of Florida. Yeah. That money can only come from the federal government, and it can only be implemented with the federal government and the state working together. If you go back in history, like there was the disaster of Hurricane Katrina, right, in Louisiana, in New Orleans, and the federal government and the Bush administration and the Democratic leadership in Louisiana from the governor and the mayor, they did not work well together. What happened? Bush never recovered politically. Yep. The governor of Louisiana didn't even run because she would have lost. And the mayor of New Orleans went to jail. Okay, now that didn't have anything to do with the Katrina response. But, I mean, this is what happens. You have to work together. And they will work together. And you saw this when we had Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey. And very famously, this was right in the heat of a presidential election, the Republican governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who was a significant surrogate for Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee. He worked very closely with President Obama. And in fact, this was used against Christie later on when he ran for president, because there's a picture where it looked like Obama and Christie were hugging one another in the aftermath of Sandy. And Chris Christie said, I would do that again every single time because we had to do this for the people of New Jersey. It is going to happen for the people of Florida. Ron DeSantis is running for re-election right now. He's not going to score political points on this. And that's not who Joe Biden is. I mean, it's we've got Americans who are really hurting right now and are going to be hurting for months to come.
Well, just to add to that, 2 million people are still without power. The death toll is currently 21, but will rise, according to everyone on the ground. Joe Biden has called it arguably the worst major storm disaster that he can remember. The question I would ask is, and Glenn and I discussed this briefly before we went on air, how long can this keep happening? Meaning, we're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars every year as people, for whatever reason, continue to live beside flood zones that climate change experts are telling us it's only going to get worse. What point does that political economic situation overlap? There's already situations where insurance companies won't insure homes. This is happening in America and other countries. Is there a tipping point?
Well, that, I mean, so the question is, as you rightly phrased, Neil, what are the ramifications going to be for this from a legislative perspective on how to try and prevent these from happening, these types of disasters, or getting worse.
Right.
This storm snuck out, as you mentioned, snuck out of nowhere because the water is so warm. And
so
warm currents,
yeah.
And now you're going to get more and more and more of these. And are people going to wake up? And where you have this big debate now where you have states like Florida and Texas are telling businesses, if you have an ESG, or telling companies, if you have an ESG mentality, we're not going to let you do business with the state. If you as a bank are going to take ESG into account when you're doing your financing, especially when it comes to coal and other types of energies, we're not going to let you do business with the state. But what's going to happen with this battle that we now have, where you have the certain people saying we have to take environmental, social, and governance into account, especially when it comes to climate change, and then you have these Republicans saying, oh, well, that's woke capitalism, and we're not going to allow it. Let's see if these types of disasters shift somebody like Ron DeSantis, who is fully cooperating with the federal government. Is he now going to say, well, I may have to change my policies a little bit when it comes to legislation and climate risk? That has to happen. And will this be a tipping point? Will Hurricane Ian be a tipping point to making that happen? I'm not holding my breath.
There are certain politicians, there are certain wings, a certain wing of the Republican government, the Republican Party, that says big government is bad. Let's get it out of our lives until they need some money for something.
Until their beachfront properties.
until their constituents are in a very a tenuous position. How are they going to justify those previous comments with what they're asking for now and what they ask for after every disaster?
Well, look, in 2013, right, after Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, and Ron DeSantis was in his very first term. It was like his literally first month as a member of Congress. And he opposed a $9.7 billion flood insurance aid package to New Jersey, Jersey.
For the Northeast,
Jersey. Yeah. And he was, look, this overwhelmingly passed. There were only 67 votes against it. And the entire delegation of Florida, because they knew, hey, this could happen to us too, they voted for it, except for DeSantis and one other Republican congressman. And now that wing of the Republican Party that existed in 2013 is even stronger now. Will you see opposition to Florida from Republicans who say, no, we can't afford to give them $120 billion to help clean this up? I hope not. Yeah. And let's hope that we get disaster relief out of politics. But it played a part back in 2013. It seems to be playing a bigger part now. And let's see if a lesson like this and somebody like Ron DeSantis, who says, we need the help, if that changes other Republicans.
We got 5 minutes left. We got to move on. Our last topic of today, the Milken Institute conference that was here this week, you and I attended, 1,300 executives from not just around Singapore, and the region, but around the world descended on Singapore for business meetings, panel discussions, Americans, talking about the post-pandemic world, et cetera, et cetera. Interestingly, there was a live link to the U.S. ambassador to China, Burns, and talking about that relationship. Take us through what some of his comments were vis-a-vis China, America, Southeast Asia, the region.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things that Ambassador Burns said is that, look, Hong Kong is now a shadow of itself. And look, you come out of this conference and everything that's been happening, there's no battle between Singapore and Hong Kong for who's going to be the financial hub of Asia. Singapore has won. This is over. I mean, everybody who is at that conference, who you're talking to, is either moving here or thinking about moving here, or their companies have moved here. Yeah. No one is thinking about the reverse of going to Hong Kong. So it is clear that Singapore is now a real center of gravity in Asia, and maybe the center of gravity when it comes to the regional perspective. And a lot of that has to do with China. And that is because it is very clear that China underscores almost all of the discussions that take place. And Ambassador Burns was extremely strong in his statements that we are seeing, and to quote Ambassador Burns, saying, we are seeing a new offensive, if you will, by the People's Republic of China. They're the party that's changing things. It's not the U.S. that is changing the status quo. It's not Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan that is changing the status quo that we've had in the region and from China. It is Xi Jinping who has changed that. So it was very, very much a strong message from Ambassador Burns. And what was really interesting is that there was very little discussion about China during the open panels because nobody wants to say anything because they are afraid of the consequences.
Backlash.
It's an undercurrent on everything. And I'll just say last piece, Ambassador Kaplan from Singapore, in his remarks, he didn't even mention China in his remarks. Didn't mention the word once, and yet the headline from one of the reporters was that Ambassador Kaplan warned that Singapore's remarkable transformation is at risk due to Beijing's expansionist policies. And he didn't even mention China. But that's how much it's underscoring everything.
Wow. So in that triangle between Singapore, Beijing and Washington, how does Singapore navigate its space with the business leaders? What was the conversations coming out of Singapore?
Look, I mean, that's the challenge.
That's the decades-long challenge, right?
Because Singapore, and if you think about it, right, I mean, Southeast Asia is the only place in the world that is of importance to the U.S. and China diplomatically, militarily, economically, from an investment perspective, from a trade perspective, that doesn't want to choose. Everybody else has chosen, right? The EU has chosen, Japan has chosen, South Korea has chosen, North Korea has chosen, Australia has chosen. Southeast Asia doesn't want to choose. But how is it going to be able, as the antagonism is growing stronger between the U.S. and China, where China refuses to work with the U.S. on counterterrorism, on narcotic flows, let alone on pandemics and on climate change? How is it going to balance out here? And that's why everybody is almost walking on eggshells when it comes to talking about China publicly. Privately, different. But publicly, it's very quiet.
One top takeaway, 30 seconds, from the Milken conference. You've been, over the years, many times.
Yeah.
What was it this year? What was the headline for you?
Oh, well, I mean, the concern from especially the financial community and the economists that we are going to have a real economic hit, that it is not, it's just starting, that we've got a ways to go before we bottom out, that the debt crisis that you're seeing in emerging markets where you've got inflation and then you've got the valuation of the dollar, people aren't going to be able to service their debt, so you're going to have countries and then the corporations in those countries, they're not going to be able to pay back their loans. So what's going to happen to those businesses? What's going to happen to those countries? What's going to happen to those people? So a real negative outlook of what's happening. And I've never seen, I don't think, at Milken, the pessimism overall. The bright spot being, for the most part, Southeast Asia, that anywhere is going to weather the storm better, it's going to be here. And that may be why so many people are coming here, causing, of course, all of our rents to go up and we can't get reservations for dinners and the traffic is getting worse and airfares are ridiculously expensive because this is the place that could potentially weather the economic and the geopolitical storm better than anywhere else.
Wow. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate your input on that. We do have to go. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, positive takeaway. He has got a fine shirt on. Again, let's finish on an upbeat note. He's got the Beatles boys, Yellow Submarine. He never lets us down with the T-shirts.
First time I wore it just for you today. Now, I was hoping for Sergeant Pepper's from you. I was hoping we were going to match. I was going to WhatsApp
next
you.
Week,
to let
next
you know.
Week.
Well,
next
I can't
week.
Wear this 2 weeks in a row.
Of course you can.
No, I can't.
T-shirt wars.
If you do, hopefully you'll
T-shirt
wash
wars.
It between now and then. But all right, guys. Thanks so much. Got to run.
International News Review. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.